Good evening, everyone. This is Luke Haverly. You're listening to The Divided Kingdom. Well, here we are in July. The 4th has passed, and we're moving into the heart of summer. Here in Maryland, it's been pretty nice weather for the spring. We had a few hot, sticky days, and now I think we're getting the outskirts of a tropical storm. Got some weather that, well, let's put it this way, the farmers won't have to irrigate much for a while. Now, I thought I'd lead off today with a couple of items that have to do with health. The first one is something I don't believe that I ever heard of until a year or two ago. That's the topic of microplastics. And we'll begin with something from Slate News by Frank Bergman. The title reads, Toxic Microplastics Found in Human Reproductive Fluids Amid Global Fertility Crisis, dated July 6, 2025. And it reads as follows. A new peer-reviewed study has sounded yet another warning siren in the modern health crisis, as microplastics have now been found in human reproductive fluids, jeopardizing fertility in both men and women. In the study, researchers examined follicular fluid from 29 women and seminal fluid from 22 men, two biological substances essential to human conception. What they uncovered raises disturbing new questions about the long-term viability of natural reproduction in the modern world. A wide spectrum of synthetic pollutants was detected in the vast majority of these critical biological samples. The toxic substances that were found include, okay, here I'm going to take a crack at these names, polytetrafluoroethylene, PTFE for short, polystyrene, or PS, polyethylene, terephthalate, I guess it is, PET, polyamide, PA, polypropylene, which is PP for short, and polyurethane, PU. In women, 69%, so that's over two-thirds, 69% of the follicular fluid samples were contaminated with microplastics. In men, 55% of semen samples were tainted. And in both sexes, the most prevalent contaminant was PTFE, the same chemical used in non-stick cookware coatings like Teflon. Lead researcher, Dr. Emilio Gomez-Sanchez, admitted that while the presence of microplastics in the human body is no longer shocking, the degree of reproductive contamination was deeply concerning. He said, quote, we weren't entirely surprised to find microplastics in fluids of the human reproductive system, Dr. Gomez-Sanchez said, but we were struck by how common they were. That is, found in 69% of the women, 55% of the men we studied. This isn't an isolated case, however. A 2023 study in China reported microplastics in 100% of semen samples. One trend is becoming increasingly clear. Reproductive systems across the globe are being infiltrated and damaged by man-made polymers. The findings come amid a global silent assault on fertility. To date, over 9 billion tons. Yes, that's a billion with a B. Not million, but billion. 9 billion tons of plastic have been produced globally since 1950. And more than half of that since 2004. The result is a toxic breakdown into microplastics and even nanoplastics that have contaminated our food, air, water, homes, and now our reproductive fluids. Within our homes, synthetic clothes, carpets, and furniture continuously shed microscopic plastic fibers. These particles accumulate in household dust, infiltrate the air, and enter our bodies through inhalation, ingestion, and skin absorption. Without regulation, warning labels, or public awareness. Worse still, microplastics don't just clog tissues. They act as toxic chemical delivery systems, carrying endocrine-disrupting, brain-damaging, and DNA-altering compounds deep into the body, including to the brain, lungs, liver, and now the reproductive organs. Scientists are now linking microplastics to a barrage of modern diseases, including Alzheimer's, autism, diabetes, obesity, hormonal disorders, autoimmune conditions. The findings come as the global fertility crisis is accelerating, especially in the West in recent years. Sperm counts have been plummeting, with no sign of slowing down. Now, mounting evidence suggests that microplastic contamination could be playing a central role in this demographic freefall. Many experts now warn that natural reproduction may become impossible for many couples within a generation, with egg quality declining and sperm counts reaching historic lows across developed nations. Yet, major health agencies remain eerily silent, and little action has been taken to regulate plastic exposure or mandate transparency from manufacturers. Instead of addressing this growing environmental and reproductive health catastrophe, governments and institutions continue to prioritize climate soundbites, digital surveillance, and green talking points, all while ignoring the plastic poison choking out human fertility. No warning labels, no corporate accountability, no mainstream media panic, just more silence. The question remains, how many more studies need to confirm what parents, doctors, and skeptics already know? That plasticized, digitized, and industrialized modern life is slowly eroding the foundation of human health and reproduction. The time for polite concern is over. And again, that was from Slay News, July 6, 2025. Toxic microplastics found in human reproductive fluids amid global fertility crisis. Well, you know, some of the counties in Maryland, where I live, have banned plastic bags at grocery stores, Walmarts, all stores, in fact. Bags have to be paper, and they tend to charge maybe a nickel or a dime per bag. I used to think that was a little bit foolish. Now I'm not so sure. With articles like this popping up, I'm beginning to think maybe they had the right idea, that plastics had taken over so much of everything we do. And I've been guilty of that myself. I've been using styrofoam plates quite a bit, and now I can't get them. Unless I go cross over into Delaware, I'm not even sure I can get them there. And it's got me thinking, maybe I need to be just a little bit less lazy and take an ordinary plate and wash it every time I use it. That wouldn't be that hard to do. And it would do my part to at least a little tiny bit cut down on this. Well, that was one health issue. Here's another one. This one from the People's Voice, entitled U.S. Waterways Under Attack, Public Kept in Dark as Toxic Diquat Spraying Begins. And we have a little quote, this will kill everything. Again, that's from the People's Voice, July 4th, 2025, by Baxter Dimitri. And the subtitle says, just days after the 4th of July, lakes and rivers in Connecticut are scheduled to be sprayed with diquat. And that, by the way, is spelled D-I-Q-U-A-T. And I take it as a brand name, probably, because it's capitalized. And they say that's a highly toxic chemical banned in Europe. And concerned citizens are sounding the alarm about what they are describing as, quote, coordinated ecological sabotage, unquote. It goes on to say this. The state, that is Connecticut, has approved the use of the chemical under the pretense of targeting hydrilla, that's the scientific name of an invasive aquatic plant. Critics warn that the spraying campaign, backed by public funds and shadowed by financial interests, is a cover for something much more destructive. One source said, quote, Connecticut is about to poison its own lakes and rivers with a highly toxic chemical called Dichlot, and it seems like no one knows about it. It's actually a coordinated plan that they're about to roll out in states all over the country. Kyle Higbee on Newsmax was able to do more research and found Connecticut Democrats will begin spraying our lakes and rivers with a toxic chemical, Dichlor, on Monday. Now, that would have been the Monday after the 4th of July, so July 7th. He also found the company is owned by ChemChina. Let me interject here. This is Lou speaking. Isn't that interesting? ChemChina. You think that's got some connection with the Chinese communist dictatorship? Well, I would tend to think so, wouldn't you? But reading on, Dichlor has a documented history of devastation. Video evidence from prior applications show entire aquatic ecosystems dying within hours of exposure. Fish, plant life, and other organisms perish en masse, leaving behind what witnesses describe as dead water. And that same source says this particular chemical is banned in Europe and highly toxic to humans and wildlife alike. I've even heard landscapers refer to Dichlor as the nuclear option. And again, I'll interject, I guess that means that if you can't get rid of anything any other way, you can kill it off with this Dichlor. Going on now, the public has not been widely informed. Notices of spraying have appeared quietly on government websites with little media coverage and virtually no debate. According to concerned residents, state agencies claim Dichlor is necessary to manage hydrilla. But there is growing suspicion that the invasive plant narrative is being used to justify a lucrative contract. Dichlor spraying programs are often funded by environmental agencies with federal or state grants, and those involved reportedly stand to profit significantly. And here we have a quote. Of course, when you start to follow the money, you see how this plan has huge state funding and therefore is lining a whole lot of pockets. There's quite a few players involved. They really don't want us to know who they are and what their involvement is, unquote. Critics have compiled names and contact information for individuals and agencies they believe are behind the initiative. An effort to bring transparency to a plan they describe as coordinated ecological sabotage. Environmental experts have warned of Dichlor's severe toxicity. The herbicide is known to cause neurological, liver, and kidney damage in humans, and is especially lethal to fish, amphibians, and waterfowl. Residue can linger in sediment and drinking water sources. The whistleblower said, quote, this is not a partisan issue. It's downright evil. If you kill the water, you kill everything, unquote. Despite warnings, the spraying schedule remains in place, with Connecticut serving as the starting point for what many fear will become a nationwide program. Activists are urging immediate public opposition, calling in residents to contact state legislators, local environmental boards, and media outlets before the plan goes into effect. The question remains, who benefits from poisoning America's waterways? And will the public stop it in time? Once again, we got that article from thepeoplesvoice.tv. and the title was U.S. Waterways Under Attack, etc. July 4th was the date that it appeared. July 4th, 2025. Before I go on to the next article, just want to invite you all to visit our website, DividedKingdomRadio.com. That's DividedKingdomRadio.com. We soon hope to have some updated articles, essays that you can look at. You can, if you go to our website, you can find out all the different ways you can listen to this program. Next week, I'll try to give those in detail. But I have so much to do today, I think I'll just give you the main ones. Shortwave, you can hear us at WWCR's shortwave station, 8 o'clock Thursday evenings, Eastern Time, and the frequency is 4.840, 4840. And you can also hear on their website, WWCR.com, Worldwide Christian Radio, that's short for. If you forget the initials, just remember, Worldwide Christian Radio. And if any of you would like a copy of our book, we still have some left. Elizabeth worked very hard on that before her death, and I've made it a point to offer that to for free to anybody who just wants to write to me and request the book, and we'll send it right out to you. I'll send it right out to you. I have to get used to the idea now. I'm having to do this alone. I certainly miss Elizabeth greatly. I'm sure many of you listening do as well. And you can write to me at Lou Caverly. Now, you spell that name as C-A-V, as in Victor, E-R-L-Y. And the address is Post Office Box 28, Bethlehem. Just like that Bethlehem in the Bible, the birthplace of Jesus. Bethlehem, Maryland, 21609. Again, Lou Caverly, Post Office Box 28, Bethlehem, Maryland, 21609. And if you write to us, to me, well, I'll get a copy of that book out to you right away. I've got one we're going to mail either today or tomorrow morning. We had a request, and I will get that out to the person requesting the book. Also, our donations have really gone down. I think it's the summertime. People are busy. I certainly understand that. But I wouldn't be able to go on indefinitely paying for the program partially myself. I just don't have the wherewithal, particularly since Elizabeth's passing. I no longer get as much money coming in every month. No one gives her Social Security, and I no longer get part of her pension. So it's a little tighter than it used to be. And I know we have several faithful people that help every month, but it's not quite enough to push us over the top, particularly those months like July that have five Thursdays, because those are the days that we pay for, the Thursday evening performance. The radio station is kind enough to give us Saturday mornings free on shortwave. And the Saturday morning frequency, I believe I'm right, it's 7.490, I think, megahertz, 7.490 at 8 o'clock in the morning, again, Eastern Time. So Thursdays, 8 o'clock at night, 4.840. Saturdays, 8 o'clock in the morning, 7.490. So if you miss it at one time, or if the reception is poor, I know here in Maryland, the reception hasn't been the greatest the last few days. Shortwave is notorious for intermittent reception. Sometimes it's great, sometimes it's not so great. Sometimes you can't hear a thing. William L. Shira, I might have mentioned this a long time ago. William L. Shira, the author of The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, that very, very famous book on the history of Nazi Germany, was a newspaper reporter. He was an American who went to Europe, and just in the days leading up to World War II, he got a job in various capital cities of Europe. I think he was in Paris for a time, Vienna. But he spent most of his time in Berlin, which, of course, was a fascinating place to be in the days leading up to World War II. Getting to see Hitler live, Not many people can claim to have done that and get to hear sessions of the German Reichstag, the parliament. And William, now let's see, Edward R. Murrow offered Shira a job as a CBS news correspondent for radio. Now, Shira had never been on the radio before. His was all the printed media. So, I can remember Shira in his book called The Nightmare Years said that he was pretty shaky, pretty nervous that first trial broadcast. But he passed the test. However, in the earliest days of CBS News, coming from Berlin, it had to be broadcast via shortwave. And they had, of course, the best equipment money could buy at the time. Well, a couple of Shira's early broadcasts, when he was first getting into it, never made it to New York City. The atmospherics were such that he made the broadcast, but New York City couldn't pick up the signal. And Shira almost felt that he should go back to newspaper reporting and dump radio. But then, just when he was getting really discouraged, it came through loud and clear one night. And from that point on, I guess it was pretty good. I think eventually they laid a cable under the ocean that could carry the signal direct. Well, getting a little onto side issues there, but if you can help us, it would be greatly appreciated. Again, that address is Lou Caverly, Post Office Box 28, Bethlehem, Maryland, 21609. Now, one more health thing. I said there were two. Actually, there are three. This one is a little more immediate, and you can take some steps to prevent damage, although it may be not always easy. This is from Fox News, and I heard Dr. Mark Siegel talking about this on the radio. That's how I happened to go to the library and get this article on their printed format under the health section. This was entitled Ticks Spread to New Regions Across America, Bringing Dangerous Diseases and Need for Vigilance. And the subtitle says Lyme Disease plus Alpha Gal, ALPHA-GAL syndrome, and tick paralysis pose serious health risks, say experts. And here's what to know. This is by Chloe, and she spells it K-H-L-O-E, Quill, Q-U-I-L-L, June 27, 2025. Ticks are spreading outside their comfort zone and into ours, according to experts. As cooler regions experience milder winters, those areas are becoming more hospitable to many tick species. Van Holtel, an Atlantic-based, I wonder if that should be Atlantic, I'm not sure. Anyway, based entomologist with Orkin, the pest control company, told Fox News Digital. So Van Holtel is the scientist's name. This is because ticks prefer warmer climates. While the arachnids, and if you remember from your high school days, those are the little creatures, sort of like insects, but instead of having six legs, they have eight, like spiders. And ticks are among those arachnids. While these arachnids previously would go dormant in the cold, leaving them unable to travel very far, they are now able to stay active longer, clinging to hosts that carry them outside their typical regions. In recent years, experts at Binghamton University Tick-Borne Disease Center in New York have reported that tick-borne illnesses, typically confined to specific regions, are beginning to show up in other parts of the country. And here's a quote. Deer ticks are active any time it's over 39 degrees. So we have a lot longer active periods for ticks now, unfortunately. And that was a quote from Yetrib, Y-E-T-R-I-B, Hathout, H-A-T-H-O-U-T, who is professor of pharmaceutical sciences and director of the Tick-Borne Illness Center. And he told that to Binghamton University previously. The number of concerning tick species has risen from 1 to 5 in the last 15 years, according to experts at Ohio State University. given the spread of ticks, Ohio State University's Buckeye Tick Test Lab is now identifying, quote, the most dangerous ticks that spread diseases. Otto of the Orkin Company said it's important for people to stay vigilant as they frequently are outdoors at this time of year. He said people need to exercise caution regarding certain species, the bites they can deliver, and the diseases they can cause. He said tick surveillance and tick screening are important, unquote. The black leg tick, or deer tick, is best known for transmitting Lyme disease, especially in the Northeast, Midwest, and Appalachian regions. And let me interject, as many of you know, my late wife Elizabeth contracted Lyme disease soon after we moved out here to the eastern shore of Maryland to a more rural area. We know any number of people who have had Lyme disease. Fortunately, most of them got it later, in later years when the diagnosis was more foolproof and they got antibiotics quickly. But the name of the game is you can get this and never know it unless you really look around. And you can have these tiny little ticks on you and never know that either unless you have someone check you. Check yourself as much as you can, but if it's on your back, you're not going to know it. You need to have somebody else, a loved one, check your skin for you. Now, back to the article. While many people are aware of Lyme disease, I guess we read that, the American dog tick, found mostly east of the Rockies, can spread Rocky Mountain spotted fever, tularemia, and even cause tick paralysis. And again, this is Lou speaking. Now, I don't know if I've ever heard of tick paralysis. That sounds pretty imposing to me. I don't know much about it. I'm going to have to do a little research on that one. Back to the article, its cousin, the Rocky Mountain wood tick, poses similar risks in high elevation areas of the Rockies. According to Hathout, some of the pathogens that are only found in the south, like the Rickettsia species that cause sputtered fever, are migrating up north. That's why tick surveillance and tick screening for other things are important. And I think it's important to do it regularly. Pottle told Fox News Digital, quote, awareness is the first step in protecting yourself from tick-borne illnesses. Among the precautionary steps to take, say experts, wear long clothing, use tick repellents, and check for ticks after outdoor activity. Knowing which species to watch for can also help prevent serious tick-borne illness. And he also said another reason for the spread of ticks is the expansion of human development into wildlife habitats, which helps ticks more easily find human hosts. Ticks find their hosts by detecting animals' breath and body odors, or by sensing body heat, moisture, and vibrations, according to the Centers for Disease Control, CDC. The CDC site says, quote, some species can even recognize a shadow, unquote. In addition, ticks pick a place to wait by identifying well-used paths. And this is a loose speaking. Now, that's very interesting. That smart little critters makes it hard to outwit them, that they can actually pick the paths that we use and apparently lie in wait. And that's what this says. Then they wait for a host, resting on the tips of grasses and shrubs. Ticks can't fly or jump, but many tick species wait in this position known as questing. Chloe Quill is a lifestyle production assistant. Now, this is about the author of this article. She's a lifestyle production assistant with Fox News Digital. Now, somewhere, I might have just been in the introductory words, they talked about a certain kind of tick that can make you allergic to red meat, which is a strange one. Well, I can't find it at the spur of the moment, but I actually have a friend who has been bitten more than twice, I think, by ticks, and he had that and couldn't for, I think, 3 or 4 years eat red meat. I don't know what would happen if he did. I never thought to ask him about that. But these ticks are nothing to fool with. And, again, that was from Fox News, their health section, on June 27th. And just look for the word ticks and you'll find that article. Well, now we move on to some other things unrelated to health. One of them is the ongoing thing that we hear about every single year since the assassination of John F. Kennedy. You would think this would have died out long ago. And maybe if the government had told the truth, it would have. But people love a good mystery, and because of the government deception, the mystery has remained all these years. This is from the People's Voice, and I checked it. And you can find a similar article at several different places on the internet. If you just go to, I'll tell you when I get to that point. The article says, again, from People's Voice, by Sean Eddie Tabatabai, or Adel Tabatabai, July 6th, docs, that means documents, confirm Lee Harvey Oswald was recruited by the CIA months before the JFK assassination. And that's kind of a subheadline here. Bombshell CIA documents declassified this week under President Trump's JFK disclosure push confirmed that Lee Harvey Oswald was recruited by a high-level CIA psychological warfare operative, George Joannidis. I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly. And that was months before assassinating President Kennedy. Now, okay, let me interrupt right there. As most of you are well aware, they should have put the word allegedly in there. No one who has actually looked into this matter is at all confident that Lee Harvey Oswald assassinated President Kennedy. I have the gravest doubts about that. I think the evidence is pretty convincing that although he may be somehow, may have been somehow involved in the assassination, he was probably not the one that fired shots. In fact, there probably were at least two shooters. But with that in mind, let's go on. Reading again from the article, the 1963 memo exposes the agency's covert contact with Oswald, fueling long-standing suspicions of CIA involvement in the assassination. And again, let me interrupt. This would imply the CIA was the chief conspirator. I don't know that I would go that far. I certainly think that some men covered it up afterward who were in the CIA. In fact, the higher-ups in the CIA no doubt covered it up. They stonewalled the Warren Commission. They misled the House Select Committee on assassinations 15 years later. And did everything they could to muddy the waters so that the truth never came out, whatever that truth was. Now, going on with the article, released Thursday, the memo details Joannidis, a deputy chief of the CIA's Miami branch, being assigned a covert identity as Howard Mark Gebler, complete with a fake address and driver's license. This revelation, part of a broader effort to unveil hidden truths about JFK's death, intensifies questions about the CIA's role and the extent of their manipulation of Oswald leading up to the tragic event. And the article posts a photocopy of the source of that information about the alias for this George J. Joannidis. Joannidis, by the way, I looked this up, he was a Greek born in Athens who had come to the CIA. He played a large part, and I'll read a little bit of that for you if I can find it very quickly, in the whole disinformation campaign after Kennedy's death. But now, reading on, Infowars.com reports, Axios explains, quote, until Thursday, the agency had denied that Joannidis was known as Howard. Now, that's the Howard shown in this photocopy. It just says at the top, headquarters, meaning, of course, the CIA. Let me read that part again. Until Thursday, the agency had denied that Joannidis was known as Howard, the case officer name for the CIA contact who worked with activists from an anti-communist group opposed to Cuban dictator Fidel Castro, called the Cuban Student Directorate, or DRE for short, which I presume is from the Spanish words, short for them. A group covertly funded and directed by Joannidis' CIA branch. Members of the DRE confronted Oswald on August 9, 1963. They handed out pro-Castro pamphlets in New Orleans just months before the November 22, 1963 assassination. Oswald also debated DRE activists later that month, reinforcing his image as a communist sympathizer. A year and a half after the Pentagon's proposed Paltz Flag plan, Operation Northwoods, which aimed at laying acts of terror on the Cuban regime in order to justify a military overthrow of Castro. That plan, which President John F. Kennedy ultimately rejected, followed the CIA's botched Bay of Pigs invasion just 1 year prior. Later, Joannidis and others inside the CIA helped conceal his role, slow-walking document requests, misdirecting congressional investigators, and running, quote, covert ops, unquote, intended to undermine investigations. The bombshell document comes as previous releases have already shown the CIA lied under oath when questions about the DRE during previous congressional testimony, Axios reported. Quote, all the records disclosed so far show how the CIA lied about financing or being involved with the DRE. That includes the agency's interactions with the Warren Commission, 1964, the Church Committee, 1975, the House Select Committee on Assassinations, 1977-78, and the Assassination Records Review Board, up until 1998, unquote. Axios notes that the memo blows Joannidis' cover. And this is a quote, the new documents don't shed any additional light on Kennedy's shooting or settle the controversy over whether Oswald acted alone. Nor is there any evidence showing why the CIA covered up Joannidis' ties to DRE, unquote. And again, let me just criticize that. To settle the controversy over whether Oswald acted alone, as if that's a known fact. It is not a known fact. And anyone who takes time to look at all the evidence, and I should add, this is evidence the government themselves published. If you look back at the Warren Commission's 26 volumes of hearings and exhibits, you'll find much of the information in those very government documents showing that Oswald probably did not act alone and may very well have had no direct role in the assassination. He may have been just what he was, what he claimed to be before he was shot dead by Jack Ruby. Namely, that Lee Harvey Oswald was a patsy. He'd been set up to take the blame by higher-ups. Possibly the CIA. We simply don't know. The article concludes, the document release shedding light on the CIA's long-suspected hidden hand in the assassination was celebrated as a victory in transparency for the Trump administration, including by Representative Anna Paulina Luna, Republican of Florida, who chairs the House Oversight Committee's Task Force on Declassification of Federal Secrets. Again, that was from the People's Voice, July 6th. Docs confirm Lee Harvey Oswald was recruited by CIA months before JFK assassination. There's a wealth of information. Many, many, many books. I have, goodness knows, I think I probably have at least 30 books on the assassination myself. And it's, the more you read, the more complicated it seems to be. It was far, far from the simple act of one man that the Warren Commission tried to portray it as. Well, now, let's switch gears again. This was from the People's Voice. Jesuit priest defends LGBTQ kids' books in schools, compares them to teachings of Jesus. July 4th, 2025, by Baxter Dimitri. And the summary subheadline, Jesuit priest Father James Martin, a high-profile ally of the recently deceased Pope Francis, is under scrutiny following his response to the Supreme Court's recent decision in Mahmoud versus Taylor, which affirmed the rights of parents to opt their children out of school lessons involving LGBTQ-themed literature. In a 6-3 decision, the Supreme Court sided with parents challenging a Maryland school district's policy that required elementary school students to engage with LGBTQ books, including titles like Uncle Bobby's Wedding, which centers on a same-sex marriage. Other approved materials in the district, and I believe, by the way, let me interject there, that was Montgomery County, as you might expect, just outside the District of Columbia line, suburban Washington. So, once again, other approved materials in the district included books promoting gender transitions to young children, drawing criticism from parents and faith leaders nationwide. Rather than supporting parental rights, Father Martin issued a controversial statement implying that such books align with the teachings of Jesus, initially sharing his perspective on X, formerly Twitter. Martin later deleted the post and expanded on his views in an essay for Outreach Faith, a pro-LGBTQ Catholic platform. In his essay, Martin wrote, quote, "The Supreme Court decision on parents opting out of their children's reading books with LGBTQ characters is a reminder that objecting to LGBTQ issues often falls under the guise of religious objections. Obviously, some material is not suitable for children, especially if it's sexually explicit. But some of these books simply introduce gay characters," unquote. He went on to claim that biblical values were being misused. He said, "Pretty soon it's possible that even speaking to or doing business with an LGBTQ person or having them teach your children could be framed as a threat to one's religious values. It's important to remember that Christianity should not be used as a fig leaf for homophobia," unquote. Martin concluded by comparing LGBTQ representation in children's books to Jesus' parable of the Good Samaritan. And that parable of the Good Samaritan emphasized compassion toward outcasts. Martin said, quote, "Jesus not only reached out to those on the margins, but one of his most famous stories was about someone from a hated ethnic group. The Samaritans were at the time despised by many Jews," unquote. Critics argue Martin is downplaying legitimate parental concerns about age-inappropriate material and religious freedom, using theological language to lend moral authority to controversial social agendas. The Maryland policy did not include opt-out provisions for families with religious objections, sparking the legal challenge that led to the Supreme Court ruling. Father Martin is no stranger to controversy. He has been publicly praised by Pope Francis for his LGBTQ outreach, including a personal handwritten letter from the Pope supporting his involvement in a 2022 pro-LGBTQ Catholic conference. Martin's repeated defense of policies many see as infringing on parental and religious rights has made him a divisive figure within the Catholic Church and beyond. And if you go to LifeSite News, that's a source of a great deal of information on this Father Martin. This, however, was from the People's Voice, and the subject of the title of Jesuit Priest Defends LGBTQ Kids' Books in Schools compares them to the teachings of Jesus. And this was, if you want to get a copy of it, dated July 4th, 2025, the People's Voice. Okay. Another thing that has to do with health, at least to some extent, well, sure it does. This is in Slate News. Texas bans Bill Gates' lab-grown meat. And it was by Frank Bergman, June 29th, 2025. And when Elizabeth was still living, we spoke several times about eating crickets and the big cricket farms, I think up in Canada, where they were going to grow crickets and turn them into food. Some said it was just going to be for dog food and cat food, but we had some indications it was going to be for human food. Well, this is sort of on the same line. Let me see now. I think I said the date, June 29th, 2025. The great state of Texas has just dropped the hammer on billionaire Bill Gates and his allies by signing a new bill into law that protects the food supply from hyper-processed, fake, quote, meat, unquote, products. In a major win for food freedom and common sense, Republican Governor Greg Abbott signed into law a bold new measure that slams the brakes on the globalist push for lab-grown so-called meat. Abbott signed Senate Bill 261, officially banning the manufacturing, processing, possession, distribution, and sale of so-called, quote, cell, C-E-L-L, cultured protein, unquote, or human consumption. In simple terms, lab-grown meat is now illegal in the Lone Star State. The move is another major blow for Gates, that's Bill Gates, and his fellow globalists, who are seeking to replace real meat and dairy with fake, lab-grown, plant-derived, and insect-based products. This is Lou speaking. There you go, the insect stuff. Chiefly crickets is what I hear. But back to the article. Gates has invested heavily in several companies developing lab-grown so-called meat. These include Upside Foods, Memphis Meats, and others. Unfortunately for Gates, these products will now be banned in Texas. Gates has also invested in plant-based alternatives like Impossible Foods and Beyond Meat. Starting September 1st, Texans will no longer have to worry about biting into a burger made from Frankenstein meat cooked up in a petri dish. The move makes Texas the seventh state to shut the door on synthetic animal products. Texas is joining a growing list of red states, including Florida, Alabama, and Mississippi. These states have risen up in rejecting what many see as a globalist attempt to control the food supply. And it's no surprise this happened in Texas, home to some of the finest barbecue on earth. While Austin-based startup BioBQ had plans to debut its lab-grown brisket, the state just made it clear Texas beef comes from cattle, not cancer-like, immortalized cells modified to replicate indefinitely in a lab. The bill takes direct aim at the biotech industry's dystopian vision of, quote, sustainable, unquote, eating. This agenda is being pushed under the guise of fighting climate change. Where have we heard that before? This is Lou speaking now. Every time you turn around, some woke person is using the words climate change. But back to the article. Proponents claim that real meat contributes to greenhouse gas emissions. But what they don't mention is that livestock farming accounts for just 15% of emissions globally and is part of the natural ecosystem. Unlike endless jet-setting climate summits, mega factories, or lithium mines powering their so-called green revolution. Still, not everything in the bill is airtight. In an odd twist, the Texas ban is set to expire in 2027 and was extended, leaving the door cracked open for Big Food and Silicon Valley to try again. Critics are already warning. Critics are already warning that if this clause isn't addressed, Texas could be flooded with fake so-called meat propaganda all over again in just a few years. For now, though, the message from Texas is loud and clear. Real meat, real food, real freedom. As Gates and the World Economic Forum allies try to sell Americans lab-grown solutions to problems they created, red states are waking up and pushing back hard. The line is being drawn. Texas just took a stand for tradition, transparency, and the right to know exactly what's on your plate. Let's hope more states follow suit before the insect food and fake meat lobby makes its next move. Once again, that was some Slay News. Texas bans Bill Gates' lab-growing meat. And this one appeared June 29, 2025. Here's another victory. I heard about this again on Fox News, but the article is coming out on LifeSite News on July 3rd, 2025, written by Doug Mainwaring. The headline reads, Supreme Court agrees to rule on whether states can ban transgender men in women's sports. The Supreme Court agreed to hear two cases regarding bans on gender-confused males in female sports, and what Alliance Defending Freedom CEO Kristen Wagner calls a historic moment. This is Dateline, Washington, D.C. The U.S. Supreme Court has just announced that it will hear two cases that may settle whether states are legally permitted to protect girls and women's sports from gender-confused males. Again, let me interject there. Are they really gender-confused, or are they looking at a nice way to get some trophies by beating up on women when they couldn't hack it in the men's competition? Well, I won't judge that, but I do have some suspicions. All right, reading on. In a series of posts on X, Kristen Wagner, CEO, President, and General Counsel for Alliance Defending Freedom, who has racked up multiple wins at the U.S. Supreme Court, and who was appointed by President Donald Trump as an advisor to his newly established Religious Liberty Commission, expressed joy at the court's decision. And I think the rest of this is pretty much her words. At long last, women's sports are going to the U.S. Supreme Court. The court just announced it will hear Little versus Peacock and West Virginia versus BPJ, two cases that should settle the question of whether states can preserve women's sports for women. This is a historic moment. Explained Wagner, quote, the Supreme Court has just granted our request to hear Little versus Peacock in West Virginia versus BPJ, two cases where lower courts have undermined women's sports laws and forced schools to let boys compete in women's sports. She went on, Idaho and West Virginia, led by Attorney Generals Raul Labrador and J.B. McCuskey, are defending their women's sports laws before the court. The Alliance Defending Freedom, ADF Legal, is working alongside both states to represent them, along with three female athletes. We are standing together to defend fairness and equal opportunity for women, said Wagner. And she continued, for too long, far too long, female athletes have been sidelined, silenced, and denied the chance to be champions. While cultural winds have shifted toward reality, and nearly 8 in 10 Americans now support protecting women's sports, too many courts are still ruling for gender activists. It's time for the Supreme Court to settle the question. 53 years after the passage of Title IX, our nation is at a crossroads. We can protect the female category, or we can accept the demise of women's sports in America. I pray the Supreme Court sides with reality and with the girls. And those are the words of Ms. Wagner CEO of Alliance Defending Freedom. Well, I'll put my two cents worth in, as I have done before, but I'll do it again. This is Lilligan speaking. It seems to me the most asinine thing in the world that you let men compete in women's sports. If men want to compete in men's sports, fine. That's what they're there for. But does anybody think that it's an equal playing field if you let men who say they feel like women compete against women? No way. No way in the world. This is one of the most stupid, asinine things I've seen in my many years of life. And I can't imagine that it even has to go to the courts. Should have been settled a long time ago by simple common sense. But some of these characters have their agendas. They want to push it as far as they can. Well, again, that was from the LifeSite News. Supreme Court agrees to rule on whether states can ban transgender men in women's sports. And it appeared July 3rd, 2025. If you want to look up any of these articles, that will give you a way to get the copies made if you wish. Well, our time is running out. We had something here. I'm going to have to look this over a little bit more. When I was a kid, UFOs were big news. They had radio programs of people citing it. I can remember some big, big arguments from some astronomers who said they were nothing but misidentified natural phenomena or just ordinary stuff. And the other true believers who thought they were little men from outer space and everything in between those two viewpoints. So here we have something I'll talk about maybe next week. Over 60 UFO sightings reported whizzing across the state of New York in first half of 2025. And I'm not familiar with this group. Newport, N-U-F-O-R-C, the National UFO Reporting Center. So I might have to check out their website. Well, thank you for listening. Again, you can write to me, Lou Caraboli, Post Office Box 28, Bethlehem, Maryland, 21609. Have a good week, and tune in again next week.